Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are courts reporter Sarah Mervosh.
Hey, Tristan.
And my fellow public safety reporter, Naomi Martin.
Hey.
We'll be joined later on by editorial writer Mike Hashimoto, who just debuted his new Metro column, so congratulations to Mike. He has some things he wants to say about Baylor University and his new Hashing It Out segment. This week isn't for the faint of heart otherwise. We're talking about rape. Over the last few weeks, we've had a few stories about a few alleged serial rapists, some of the dangers of online dating, and nationally, of course, we have the ongoing Bill Cosby saga. Our guest today will be Dallas Police Lieutenant Israel Herrera, who heads the Sexual Assaults Unit at the Dallas Police Department, and Courtney Underwood, who leads the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Initiative in Dallas. She's a prominent sex assault advocate here. Victims advocate, I should say. They'll join us in just a moment.
And she's also a victim herself, I should mention.
Right, of course.
Survivor.
Yes. But first, our federal courts reporter, Kevin Krause, is here to tell us about a story that will come out in Sunday's newspaper. Kevin, what's that story about?
Yeah. Hey, Tristan. Remember those pain creams that these compound pharmacies would prescribe? They were supposed to be a miracle cure. They were supposed to alleviate all pains and aches you had. Well, last year, the federal government stopped paying for those, specifically through Medicare and TRICARE. And that was a lot of money for these pharmacies, and so they lost a lot of business. Now the latest thing is these labs that are supposed to be able to tell your cancer risk by, analyzing a mouth swab. And this is not big business, and there are allegations of kickbacks involving this program. It uses federal money. And so because of that, the federal government wants to know if doctors are being paid by these pharmacies for writing prescriptions. And it's mainly focused on the TRICARE program, which is insurance, federal insurance for military members of the military and their families. And there is a pharmacy in Fort Worth here that currently is, the subject of these allegations. There have been lawsuits alleging that that this pharmacy is paying kickbacks to doctors. And it's unclear whether the federal government is investigating it, but they are looking at all these other pharmacies all over the country.
Well, great. Well, Kevin, we're looking forward to that. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
All right, and like I said earlier, joining us in the studio is Lieutenant Israel Herrera. Thank you for joining us, Lieutenant.
You're welcome.
And Courtney Underwood.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Naomi, earlier this week you had a story about rapes and sort of the dangers of online dating. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in today's world, we see roughly 1 in 3 new marriages start with online introductions, and people are just more and more of the mainstream is using these online dating apps to find each other, find love. And so also predators are on there as well. And one of the things that Dallas Police has been seeing in recent years and increasingly last year are sexual predators going on there and basically lying about what they look like, lying about their name, and just sort of like luring in their victims that way, telling them they're going to go get dinner, and then sort of turning very violent once they get them in the car or in a sort of secluded place. And Lieutenant Herrera, I heard that y'all have seen about 2 so far this year. Is that right?
Yes. So far this year, we have 2 that we know of.
And so this is pretty scary for women like me who are single, young, on these apps because, you know, we don't have time to go hang out in bars and look for the cute guy or whatever. And we'd rather just swipe on our phone. It's so much easier. But, you know, one thing that we were talking about that I found really interesting is that you sort of tell people that they shouldn't be afraid to, like, offend guys. Like, if they, you know, one experience that I had is that I was, like, at this bar with this guy, and he was just trying to like pressure me to take shots with him. And I was like, I don't want to take shots with you. But it's so easy to get pressured into doing mm-hmm. something you don't want to do, even if it's someone you don't know. It's like that same peer pressure. So can you talk a little bit about what you tell, you know, women out there who are on these dating apps?
Yeah, your personal safety is most important to you and to nobody else, really. I mean, if you don't feel comfortable with a situation or a conversation, you know, immediately bail out. I mean, you know what? Hey, thanks for the invite, but I've got to go now. You know, you've got to really just kind of do your homework. And you touched on the fact that social media and these dating apps. You know, we live in a society where we want it all right now. It's very easy, convenient, and unfortunately, relationships take a little bit of more of a little bit more research, I guess, if you can, and asking about this person, and making sure you're meeting out in a public place and telling somebody, hey, I'm going to go out with this person, and just want to let you know where I'm going to be. And if it doesn't feel right, it's probably not right. And trust your gut and instinct. We talked about that. One of the things that we did learn that's really helpful, and we got this from one of our victims, is taking screenshots of profiles, because after these predators offend, they take those profiles down, and so it gives us a good starting point so that we know where we can begin, and then we start looking at histories, and all those things are great investigative tools for us to use to bring somebody to justice.
And Lieutenant, one thing that I've even done myself on Craigslist, like selling something on Craigslist,
right,
I always ask them, what's your full name? And then I run a criminal background check. And I think the same thing applies to dating. Like, don't be afraid to ask someone, like, what is your full name? You know, that's not a weird, that's a normal question.
Ultimately, if they're being evasive about giving you that information, then that should send off a signal to you that there's probably something not right.
Yeah, here. I was going to ask, are there any like particular things you notice in profiles of predators or any trends that people could look for?
No, there's really nothing that sticks out. I mean, it's just one of those case-by-case bases. You really just have to, if you frequent these sites, you start seeing things that are a little common that don't, after a while of conversation, it turns really creepy and you go, okay, I've seen this before. I'm not going to, but nothing that that sticks out right now that we can, say, hey, look out for this.
And you guys have seen, you were telling me, all races, all ages, different kinds of professions.
Absolutely. It's not like it fits one particular profile or anything like that. I mean, everybody uses social media, every age group, every profession. So that's why this is such a big deal for us, to make sure that people are aware of this and that they're doing their homework.
Courtney, date rape has obviously been a concern for a long time, and it's not exclusive to social media, but are you worried at all about these kinds of apps being sort of conduits for predators?
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at online dating, you look at the internet, you look at what it's done in terms of rapes, of child sexual assault cases. So we've seen an enormous increase where a pedophile in the past would attack about 117 children in their lifetime. Now it's between 250 and 350 children in the lifetime of just the average pedophile.
Wow.
And so we're beginning to see that. Yeah, we're beginning to see that with adults too, and social media and dating. And people look at a picture and they see a name and they think that, oh, this person's for real. Or, we have mutual friends on Facebook. They're safe, so I can go out with this person. And, I know the Dallas police far too well to be able to use any dating apps, because everybody on the sex assault would kill me. And the sergeants have asked. They've said, you're not on any dating apps.
And we're not here to say that there's one app better than the other, or anybody does it worse than the other. It's just kind of, it's a buyer beware kind of thing,
Well, and one thing I noticed in a trial that I was covering recently about an alleged serial rapist, he had actually used Backpage.com, which is not as mainstream as something like Tinder, but Backpage is where people might sell sex online.
Sure.
And this guy would set up dates with women online, expecting they thought he was going to pay for the date, and that would be consensual. Then they show up, they're lost, they can't find him, and all of a sudden he's behind them raping them, and that's still rape, because they didn't consent to that.
So
that also speaks to a different type of sexual assault that we need to be worried about, is specifically rapists and serial rapists targeting really vulnerable women, and prostitutes often.
And those classified online type of ads, they're not just sexual assault that's occurring. You're getting it's a catalyst for robberies, and we've seen homicide where they use that avenue to get people into a particular area or a particular location. And so, again, it's just one of those where you just really have to do your homework on.
And you guys, I remember you telling me that you guys have seen rapes reported from meetings on the following apps: Tinder, Keek, which apparently is completely anonymous, and they're based in Canada or something, so it's hard to do search warrants on them. Plenty of Fish, Moco Space, Meet Me, and Facebook. So it's a really wide range of apps, and I know a bunch of friends who are on Tinder and Plenty of Fish. So,
and you know what's really funny is a lot of these. I mean, we know the mainstream names that we see and hear or know someone that's on, but a lot of times we learn from our victims where they, you know, where they met, and none of us have heard of them. So, you know, it's just one more to add to you know, to our list to go down and just to have knowledge of. So it's an ever changing environment, and we have to be adaptable to it to understand how they work.
What have you seen when talking to the victims? Like, what are they, you know, what are they saying afterwards?
Well, you know, every victim story is different. We all have a different level of trust. And again, like I said, you know, in the, from the beginning, our victims really did nothing wrong. You know, they were preyed upon. They were put in bad situations, and I guess they felt like they just couldn't get out. But, you know, I think what's important about them is that, you know, we learn from them. But, you know, there's really nothing that comes out that, you know, that stands out that we could point out to anybody.
Let's talk about the problems with prosecuting rapes and with connecting these. Sarah, you covered the trial of Waldrop Brooks last week and the week before that. Could you tell us a little bit about that case?
So Waldrop Brooks, he's accused of targeting vulnerable women. Similar pattern here. Prosecutors say he's responsible for nearly 20 rapes and robberies. So basically his MO, they say, was to target vulnerable people, either women who were walking alone in a bad area at night or prostitutes. And it was all in this sort of concentrated area in the Redbird area near where he lived. And the idea was that he would hold them at gunpoint, rape them, and take their cell phone or purse. And sometimes he would do one or the other. And so they weren't there weren't like necessarily nearly 20 rapes, but they were all sort of the same pattern. And we heard from two of the victims. I heard specifically from two of the victims last week during trial. I believe Moore testified that when I wasn't there, and they basically said that he targeted them, and they were afraid. In one case, she was afraid to report it because she didn't feel like anything would be done.
So, Courtney, do you see this often where people are, you know, what's I guess the problems with connecting these kinds of cases where we have these serial rapists who basically go on, you know, attack multiple women and are never caught?
So the reality is that the average sex offender will attack 9 women before ever being caught or even questioned by police. The biggest element of that is that sexual assault is the most underreported crime in our nation. So still fewer than 18% of sexual assaults are reported in our country.
Wow.
And that makes it a huge challenge for police because you can't investigate a case that you don't know about. And you look at the rape kit backlog that, you know, nationally everyone's beginning to work through. The police department's done an incredible job, but you're beginning to see so many CODIS hits, about 3 times more than what was originally expected, because all of these kits weren't tested, but these guys are in the system. So I think there's this idea, and especially when you start getting into, you know, date rape and, oh, this, or they knew each other beforehand, people think like, oh, it was a misunderstanding. He said, she said. No, these are predators, and they attack one woman, and then they go out and they attack another woman. It's a pattern, but it's also not something where they do it once and then stop.
And Courtney, you're actually a survivor yourself. And can you tell us what happened and why you were afraid to report it?
Yeah. So I was assaulted at knife point by my pastor when I was 15 in Dallas. And when I looked for help, there wasn't any. We were the largest city in the country without an independent rape crisis center. We also didn't have a sexual assault nurse examiner program. Parkland was the only hospital in all of Dallas County that even did rape kits. So there wasn't a hotline to call. There wasn't anywhere to look to for help. And I didn't know what to do. It was my pastor. It was an authority figure. It really just came out of the blue. I was really involved in church. He had a normal pastoral relationship with me. He had never done anything before that. So all of a sudden, you know, he's got a knife to me and is sexually assaulting me. And I didn't know what to do. When I looked for help, there wasn't any. And that's why I didn't report.
And you were so young, too. And that's a very different experience than some of these women who are very poor or on the margins or worried they were committing prostitutes committing a crime. And so basically, I mean, it happens to all types of people. But in this case, with the Waldrop Brooks case, you know, one of them didn't report it because she felt like there was nothing would be done because that she didn't have a good ID. The other one did report it, but she lied to police about what was really going on because she was going there to be a prostitute, and so she was worried about getting in trouble. And so that's, I mean, I believe that's why police had trouble tracking it down, and eventually they only tracked it down because they found cell phones connected to all these women in his apartment. And so that the evidence pointed them to the women, and then they later told them what actually happened.
Yeah, that's really important for us to get out to our victims, that we don't care what you did to get into that situation. That's not relevant right now. What we want to know is what this person did to you, and if it was wrong, we need to hold them accountable for it. So it does take a while for them to get through that, but once they get through that, we're there genuinely to help them out for the sexual assault and not for what they did to put themselves in that situation, then we start getting a little bit more cooperation, and then they feel a little bit more at ease. And again, this is a crime of control that has been taken away from them, and our job is to make it seem like this is theirs. They're here to control it now. They're getting control back in their life, and we're there to help them put those things back together.
And I think, you know, you're not going to come across a single sexual assault victim who immediately afterwards doesn't feel like people are going to blame them, that doesn't feel ashamed. I mean, that's how I felt. And I knew rationally that I didn't do anything to bring on what my pastor did, but I thought everybody's going to blame me. I was so ashamed. I felt dirty. When you look at Monica Cora's book, she was the SMU track star who was abducted at gunpoint and raped by three men for over almost an hour and a half. When you read her story, I think one of the most powerful lines is, you know, they throw her out of the car naked, throw her dress. She's out in the street trying to get somebody to stop. And there's a part of her that just thinks, maybe I should just go home. Like, maybe I should just not report this. And the fact that after what she went through, there's a part of her that's thinking, I don't want everybody in my life to know that this just happened. I can't handle this. I just want to go home. I want to take a scalding hot shower, and I want to just put this behind me. And that's why delayed reporting happens. It's why so many survivors don't come forward until down the road when they find out that the guy who assaulted them is being prosecuted, and now they feel safe to come forward because they know that they're not alone. So it's so important that all of us sort of work together to stop victim blaming, to create a new environment so victims feel safe. And I think the police department does an incredible job of that. But every single news story that gets covered and supports victims and tells their side, I think it's important.
And that is one of the challenges to prosecuting rape cases. Tristan, you asked about that in the beginning. I mean, delayed reporting does pose a problem for prosecution because then you don't have, if you don't have a sexual assault kit done, there isn't physical evidence. And in this case with Roderick Brooks, he claimed that the sex was consensual, and that often happens. And so that is part of the problem. And then also just like in this case, there was a lot of victim blaming going on during prosecution, and in terms of, well, you know, she was doing this, she was doing that. And that's, you know, that's the defense's job. That they need to defend their client. But it's anything that's how the victim feels, it's understandable. But, you know, people who do report it are so brave because they can stop more attacks from happening, like you said, if it's a repeat offender.
Absolutely.
And right, what you said there, I mean, that doesn't apply in a lot of other criminal cases. You know, robbery, a lot of time there's not necessarily physical evidence if you're just putting up a gun near someone. But there's no such thing as like a consensual robbery. So it's probably a lot easier to prosecute those cases than I think there's just an understanding that, you know, a fear of sex and you know, what that actually means between people, and, you know, consensual versus non-consensual.
You know, physical evidence obviously does help out a lot, you know, getting the DNA. And Courtney mentioned being having their DNA in our database, or the national database, CODIS is what she referred to earlier. But, you know, we're not afraid to take a case to court where it's just their word versus the other, and we have witnesses that can corroborate. There's other ways of getting evidence. There's video evidence, and there's just people who have seen things that really maybe not are afraid to come forward, and then they come forward finally to kind of help paint a clearer picture for us.
And because of these challenges, that's often why prosecutors will just prosecute one out of several cases, try to get the best they can on one case that they can prove instead of trying to go after all 19 or all six. And in this case with Waldrick Brooks, he was sentenced to 50 years for aggravated sexual assault and 20 years for robbery. They run concurrently. So essentially it's 50 years. But that's where he's going. And I think prosecutors are pretty happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of touched on this before, but Naomi, you wrote a story about women who were prostitutes and were afraid of reporting this guy who had attacked, who allegedly attacked them. And there were a bunch of them, and really they all had a hard time kind of coming forward. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this kind of touches on a lot of issues that we see in rape cases around the country, but it's a really stark example because it also involves a rape kit backlog. And basically, this guy Joseph Beatty, who's in jail right now in Dallas, awaiting trial on 3 charges of sexual assault. The first 2 are from 2009, so it took 6 years for him to get arrested on these cases because basically the victims in the cases, you know, according to Dallas police, were hard to find. They reported the rapes, they got rape kits done. The DNA was never tested right after that because the police at that time were only really trying to process the tests. They only had the money, the manpower to process tests where they felt they had the best chance of getting a conviction. You need a victim to testify to get a conviction in pretty much every case. So that's where these victims sort of, you know, 2 of them in 2009, the police said they just like had trouble finding them. And then there were 2 more in 2009 that he hasn't been arrested on, who also they just couldn't find again. And so I caught up with one of these victims recently after the guy was arrested. And she told me that, you know, she just didn't feel like anyone would believe her. She's a prostitute and she's a drug addict. She's on PCP. She has a really hard life. She's been on drugs since she was 14. And she just felt like no one would believe her. She wasn't even sure the police believed her. You know, I told her it seemed like they did since they arrested him.
Yes.
But it's so hard for these women sometimes to get over that self-shame sometimes, which I think comes from society and culture. But anyway, so he remained free for a long time. His DNA was in the system from 2001 from being in prison. And he continued offending, according to police. He raped a woman in Arlington, according to, you know, her DNA, and wasn't indicted in that case. And then in 2014, he was managing a halfway house in Dallas and allegedly assaulted a woman who worked at the halfway house and was a resident there trying to get over her alcoholism. And she is now telling me that, you know, she's really glad she reported. She wasn't gonna report it because she just wanted to get on with her life. But it just so happened she got extremely lucky that another woman called her the day after it happened and basically asked her, hey, has he ever assaulted you? Because she had just heard that a family member reported him to the police. And so that was, so she said, well, you know, it just so happened last night something happened. I woke up bleeding and in pain. And he was the only one in the house, and I vaguely remember him getting in bed with me. And so she was able to report it to the police, and that was the case that actually allowed the police to put him in jail and connect these other cases to his rape kits, but to his DNA. And I know that's very complicated. Y'all can read my story, which lays it out better. But I just think that, you know, it's so hard for these women to come forward. Can you talk about, like, how do you get them to come forward, like, when they come to you and they're not sure they want to continue, Lieutenant? Like, how do you do that?
There's a lot of patience involved in it, and we have to gain their trust and let them know that what they did, or, you know, whatever walk of life they come from, that we're not here to judge them. We're here to help them. And once they get through that and stop listening to other people saying, oh, the cops aren't going to do anything, and you got to give us a chance to help you, first of all. It's our job to bring those people to justice. It's not our job to judge you or what you did to get in that situation. So a lot of patience, a lot of conversations, and again, giving them the control to say, okay, I'm ready now. We have a number of victim advocacy groups out here that we offer to help them through the process, to talk them through, to feel comfortable with talking to us. We don't coach them what to say or anything. It's just to get them to feel comfortable enough to talk to us so that we can get the facts that we need to prosecute.
Courtney, you mentioned earlier that alarming statistic about 9 attacks before anyone's ever questioned by police, that these attackers are able to attack so many women. I mean, why do you think that is?
I think it's a lot of different issues. Like we sort of talked about earlier, there's such a huge amount of shame that victims feel afterwards. They're afraid they're not going to get believed. They're afraid everybody's going to look at them and see them as dirty because that's how they feel. And as survivors, we can all say it's going to get better. People are going to support you. No one's going to blame you for this. But I also think, you know, we're moving into a culture where we're trying to get people to understand that the police are there for us, for all of us as citizens. Like, they're not big scary. And I think if victims felt more comfortable just knowing, you know what, you can go talk to the police department. And we really encourage this on college campuses as well. So there are a lot of students, when they're sexually assaulted, they don't know what they want to do. SMU students, particularly when they've come to me, I've said, look, let's just go talk to one of the SMU cops. Like, I know this guy, I know this woman. We can go talk to them. We can have a conversation. They're not going to have to do anything. This could just put you in more control so you understand this is what the police are going to say your options are. They're going to tell you that it's not your fault. And sometimes those cases may not go anywhere. The survivor may decide, you know, I don't want to deal with the process of law enforcement, or maybe that case doesn't make its way to court, even though they try and get it there. But down the road, that case will make a difference because the likelihood is that that perpetrator will end up back in the system. But
Courtney, if you're saying that, you know, victims often feel dirty, they feel like it's their fault, and I think that's natural to question, like, what did I do? What's wrong with me? Why did this happen to me? But I think it's important to think about, you know, what's wrong with this guy? Why is he doing this to people? And mm-hmm. So the question is, how often is it that, I mean, are all rapists serial rapists? I mean, or is there evidence that it can just happen one time?
That's the one for the statisticians to answer. I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, we were talking about the gentleman you were talking about earlier, you know, 19 offenses. So those do happen. I don't think, I mean, you will probably have your one and done and that's it. But I don't know. And there's numbers out there to say they will repeat 7 to 9 times. It's just everyone's different. Every case is different.
I guess that's just important for survivors and victims to know when it happens. It's like, you know, odds are this could happen to someone else.
Yeah. Odds are you weren't the first. And when mm-hmm. you look at college campus stats and what the White House put out in terms of reports on college campuses, so over 63% of male students who admitted to a completed or attempted rape admitted to an average of 6. And these are young people, you know, 18, 19, 20. They haven't been on campus that long. So you think about if that's how many they've already purportedly on average committed, what happens when they get out of college? When you transfer them, you know, they get picked out of one college, they tend to just go to another one. They reoffend. So I think you see that throughout. Statistics really show that a predator is a predator. And because sex is about, rape is not about sex, it's about control. It's about forcing your will onto someone and taking that. This isn't something that normal people want to do. You know, this idea of, you know, the signals got crossed and the guy didn't really mean to do that. No, most normal men, if you start saying no, pushing them off, they can stop. Like, they're not really these Neanderthals that, you know, like, you can't stop them now. They thought they were going to. So I think we all have to step back and recognize there's a fear to label someone as a rapist and someone as a predator because we don't like, you know, we can say like, oh, you're a murderer, or, oh, you're a robber, like you're a bad person. But rapist, saying somebody's a rapist is so hard culturally. And I think we have to try and push past that.
This idea that you mentioned of the inability to stop, this was something that was mentioned, I think, by the creator of founder or Return of Kings recently. And they brought up this advertised all these events nationwide that were basically kind of pro-rape events or mm-hmm. or pro-rape in certain circumstances. From a Dallas police perspective, when you see things like that, first of all, what do you know about that event? And I heard that it was canceled today. But when you see things like that, is that common? Is that alarming to you guys?
Not common, but definitely alarming. We, you know, when we heard of it, we immediately asked our Fusion. We have a Dallas Police Fusion Center that's wonderful at vetting information and getting to the root of, you know, whoever started these types of conversations. And well, they were able to tell us that there's really no teeth to this thing. They told us yesterday that they didn't think this was going to happen. The fact is that we knew about it. the division that the event was supposed to take place. The commander there was aware of it and his staff. And so we had a prepared response. Our intelligence folks were well aware of it. So, you know, we're on the same page. And so when if something were to come about, we would be there for a response should it be needed.
I think one of the things that men get so sensitive about is like these sort of more like gray area type rapes where maybe not a weapon or force was even used, but it's just like both people are drinking and there's like alcohol involved or drugs, and like the victim maybe just couldn't push him off or wasn't even aware that he was like having sex with her until she woke up. I mean, are those sort of issues that you're seeing, Courtney, with in terms of like victims who don't want to report, but they come to seek services because they feel violated, but they don't necessarily feel like it amounted to a legal case?
No, absolutely. Those are really common cases. I think that people are too apt to, whenever they hear college sexual assault, they kind of want to put everything in that box. And that's not the case. And the majority of cases, someone who's forcing himself onto another person, they know what they're doing. So even if they're drunk, like there's a certain level of responsibility, personal responsibility that we all have. And it's important for victims to understand, too, where that legal threshold is. If you were drunk, you couldn't consent. If you had been drinking this amount, if you passed out on a couch, that's not giving somebody the red light to assault you or have sex with you or hit you. I mean, there's so many different things. If we just took sex out of it, we were talking about robbery earlier, and no one is like, oh, well, did you really get robbed? And like, well, why did you leave your window open?
I actually saw this really interesting video. I don't know if you guys have seen it online. It's a British guy narrating. It's the most British thing ever. It's about tea, and it says, and it's an analogy to rape. And it's like, if you ask someone, would you like some tea? And they say no, don't force them tea. Like, if they pass out and they're sleeping, like, unconscious people don't want tea. Please don't force it down their throat. Like, it's like, it's just very, so when you do that, remove the sex from it and just take it to anything else, it's so obvious. So just apply, if you're offering someone tea and they don't want it, don't give them tea. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
So what can be done to change the stigma for victims? And is that sort of changing, or is it better now than it was before?
I think it's slowly getting better. I think that we're talking about sexual violence more. We're talking about the issues. We're nationally looking at these topics. Internationally, you know, you sort of saw everyone jump on this ridiculous Return of Kings guy who doesn't deserve any attention. But I would just say, if people can look at it this way now, if you partake in victim blaming at any point when you're looking at a sexual assault case, like, you're basically aligning yourself with this lunatic. So let's take his insane message and redraw the attention to looking at this issue and saying, okay, well, why would someone even take this position, and how could he have followers? What are the problems? What are our social norms? And I think the movement that we're seeing on college campuses, where students that are survivors are coming out and they're talking and they're going to the press and they're saying our university is not paying attention, I think we're really growing a lot of young leaders who are hopefully going to make this topic, this issue of sexual violence, remain in the forefront for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And hopefully that will change more.
All right, Lieutenant Courtney, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Our pleasure.
That's all for us today. We'll end things with Hashing It Out in just a moment. I want to thank Lieutenant Israel Herrera and Courtney Underwood for coming in today. We want to thank you for listening. We hope you like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. Don't forget to visit DallasNews.com for all your crime news during the week. Our producer and sound engineer today is Brian Elledge. For Naomi Martin and Sarah Mervosh, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. And now we drop the mic.
You don't have to like Title IX or agree with it to recognize that it's the law of the land. It prohibits discrimination based on sex. It requires schools that receive any federal funds to take immediate and appropriate steps to investigate and to help a sexual assault complainant with security, counseling, academic help, and other remedies before that person is deprived of an educational opportunity. Baylor is the world's largest Baptist university and benefits from federal student loan guarantees. And Baylor has fallen terribly short of its duty in at least two cases of rape allegations against scholarship football players. Baylor, unfortunately, could not or would not verify accusations against Tevin Elliott and Sam Ukwuachu. Only intervention by the McLennan County DA's office brought them to justice. Each was convicted of sexual assault against fellow Baylor students. The university contends that it's cleaned up this act, which would appear so. Does this wash away all past sins? Not as long as those athletes' victims face the ongoing trauma of sexual assault. That is not accountability. The U.S. Department of Education is investigating 161 schools for Title IX compliance. How can Baylor not be on that list? Football is important, and Baylor is among the nation's best. That doesn't change the facts, and it doesn't change the law.